Greetings to everyone. We are now live for our program on Saturday, September 10th, 2016. Today's talk is coming from Sydney, Australia. Joining us is Daniel Hubicki, who will be sharing with us the existences and the spiritual trajectory of the Venerable Master Samael Aumbeor. So we are honored to have him with us today and for him to be talking about Venerable Master Samael. You can share your comments or questions with regards to today's talk with us. Send us an email at goradiradio@gmail.com and we will be sure to take these questions or comments at the end of the talk. So now, without further ado, we present Daniel Hubicki.
Hello to everyone who's listening, and a special thanks to the guys at Karate Radio again for offering this program and giving me this opportunity to speak today. The topic that I wanted to speak about today is the past existences of Venerable Master Samael Aumbeor and his spiritual trajectory from the past, the present, and into the future. One thing that always impresses me about Master Samael, and something that I really admire, is his capacity of awakening. Obviously, he's a very special being, as we know, and I'll discuss in this talk, a special bodhisattva called the Dhyani Bodhisattva, who is the son of a cosmic creator. And this impressive awakening, level of awakening, allows him to be very precise in every aspect and every detail of his esoteric processes, and also allows him to use his incredible memory to reach into even the distant past to remember his existences and his processes. I think that Master Samael does something that's very unusual in regards to masters, in that he shows us his entire process, even from the point of being a normal humanoid person. That entire process that's lived through many, many existences, and that process that finally reaches a perfection of mastery and finally culminates with a third philosopher's stone in this most recent existence. This is why to study the existences of Master Samael, as well as his esoteric processes, is also to study the very same teachings of the Gnostic doctrine, because he interweaves and deposits the teachings using himself as a living example of this process. And that's marvelous, because he takes us from the point of being a normal, common person with so many problems, with so many defects and issues, through that process of becoming a fully self-realized master. This, I believe, should always give us the impression of the possibilities of our own work. That's really what Master Samael is interested in for us, that each one of us takes up this path of the being and lives it in a complete and full way. So what I want to do is try to begin at the beginning, as far back as Master Samael speaks about himself in his processes of transformation, which is his process of becoming a cosmic creator and beyond. And where he takes us in his writing is a place that no longer exists, a planetary system, a universe that's so ancient that exists even before the last Mahamanvantara. And he takes us again to a point where he is an essence incarnated into a humanoid body. And he takes us this time to the exact same place that we're finding ourselves now, which is the fifth root race of that planet in the times of what were similar to this Kali Yuga. And he says, then he was just a poor intellectual animal condemned to the sorrow of living. And he said that he went from bad to worse, incessantly reincorporating in male or female bodies in accordance with the debts or credits of karma. He says, in plain language, I confess that my natural mother worked in vain creating bodies. I always destroyed them with my vices and passions. The last existence was something definitive. He says he was in a female body in that 108th existence, and that in his words, he wallowed in the bed of Procrustes, and it served him as a passport to hell. He said, in the bowels of that mineral world, I blasphemed, I cursed, I offended, I insulted, fornicating shockingly, and I degenerated more and more without any sign of repentance. I felt as if I was falling into the remote distance of the past. The human form disgusted me. I preferred to assume the form of beasts in those abysses, later appearing as a plant, a shadow that slid here and there, and finally I felt I was fossilizing. to turn to stone, what horror! Yet as I was in such a state of degeneration, it was of no importance to me. In the city of the living dead, to see as the leprous, fingers falling off, ears, nose, arms, and legs is certainly not pleasant. Still nothing moved me. I fornicated unceasingly in the bed of Procrustes with whatever larva came near, and I felt myself extinguishing like a taper, fire, or candle. Life in the mineral entrails of such a planet obviously was excessively monotonous. That is why, since I wanted to kill long and tedious amounts of time, I wallowed like a pig in filth. I became frightfully debilitated, falling into pieces and dying painfully. I disintegrated with hideous slowness. I no longer had the strength to think. It was better this way. At last, the second death came, about which St. John spoke about in the Apocalypse. I exhaled my last breath, and then the essence was freed. Well, I find those lines formidable, remembering that process of the involution of the mechanical disintegration of the ego through the levels of the abyss. And then he describes that marvelous moment when he reached the bottom of the abyss, when there's an atomic door and there are sacred devas that are there who inspect now this essence, making sure that there is absolutely no residue of the ego. And then he was freed. He began a process of evolution. He said, evidently the ego had died. The myself, my freed soul, now assumed the beautiful shape of a tender infant. What happiness, my God, how great is the mercy of God. The essence liberated from the ego is completely innocent and pure. The ego is that which is converted to cosmic dust within the bowels of this world. How long did I live in the infernal worlds? I do not know. Possibly 8 to 10,000 years. Already, and there's a marvelous teaching that the abyss is not for eternity, as is sometimes taught, that every crime in the end has its appropriate punishment, but there's another opportunity always for everyone. And he continues, he says, now devoid of ego and back on the evolutionary path, I entered the world of gnomes or pygmies, beings who work with the clay of the earth, innocent elementals of the mineral kingdom. Later, I entered the paradises of the elementals and the plant kingdom. I reincorporated constantly as plants, trees, and flowers. How happy I felt in the temples of Eden, receiving the teachings at the feet of the devas. Happiness in the paradise of the genas is inconceivable to human reasoning. Every family in those Edens has their temples and their instructors. We are filled with ecstasy upon entering the sanctuary of the orange groves or the chapel of the elemental family of mint, the church of the eucalyptus. In dealing with the evolutionary processes, we must put forward the following declaration. Natura non facit saltus. Nature doesn't take leaps. So therefore, he continued this process of evolution, enjoying the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom. He describes existences as, he remembers one in particular of being a frog and how wonderful he felt. And he remembered that humanoid state that he once had. He remembered his friends, which were the elementals of the plants, and how he loved to swim in the waters. Into finally, through that long process of evolution, he once again reconquers that humanoid state and is given another 108 existences. He never says how many times this happened, that he went through this, the wheel of samsara, how many turns of the wheel of samsara. But this last time was definitive. Now in a new humanoid state, he remembered those moments of being in the involution. He said, past experience had left painful scars in the depth of my soul, and I was in no manner disposed to repeat the involutive processes of the infernal world. I knew well that the wheel of samsara turns unceasingly and in an evolutionary and involutionary way, and that the essences, after having passed through the intellectual animal kingdom, descend millions of times to the horrific precipice to eliminate the subjective elements of perception. I think this is also another marvelous teaching, to know that we, as an essence, have come in and are trapped on this wheel of samsara. And the greatest help that Mother Nature gives us through the process of evolution is to create for us this human or humanoid type body. But something else is required to come off of the wheel, a real conscious revolution. And so he said, in one of my new humanoid existences, with a restless consciousness, as though sensing a strange terror, I resolved to inquire into, to investigate, and to seek the secret path. A wise old proverb says, when the disciple is ready, the master appears. The guru, the guide, appeared to take me out of the darkness into the light. He taught me the mysteries of life and death. He showed me the path of the razor's edge. Thus the mystery of the golden blossom came out. I understood my own situation in depth. I knew that I was only a poor homunculus, yearning to become a true man. And it is obvious that I achieved this in that great cosmic day, that sidereal day before yesterday, long before the Mahamanvantara of Padma or Golden Lotus. So it's clear that in this ancient unknown universe, the day before yesterday, that he finally achieves the human state. Now this implies someone who has constructed the solar bodies and also someone who has incarnated the human soul. In other words, for the first time, he has achieved the state of bodhisattva. Itself has profound esoteric implications, because as Master Samael explains, someone who arrives to the state of bodhisattva, a true man with the solar bodies, either fallen or raised, no longer subjected to that same cycle of 108 existences. In some ways, they break with one law and now enter into a new law. What that also means is that those solar bodies are practically indestructible, practically immortal. And if we think about that with Master Samael, these are the same solar bodies that he has again in this existence. And so this is what he says. He says, any Dhyani Bodhisattva, not just me, has created the superior existential bodies of the being in other periods of cosmic manifestation. Not just precisely now. My particular case is not unique. It is one of the many cases that exists in the megalocosmos. So this is important for us to remember, that the archangels, the cosmocrators, and their Dhyani Bodhisattvas didn't come exactly from that same Mahamanvantara, that same cosmos that they created. They were forged, they were created in past Mahamanvantaras, in past times. And that makes a lot of sense, because these great beings come already with a lot of experience in creation. Now, another incredible mystery, that Master Samael in those times created the solar bodies, obviously was raised in the first mountain at least, but didn't achieve a philosopher's stone, because he reports that his first philosopher's stone was formed in the Padma of Gold, which is the lunar round or the previous Mahamanvantara, or in the esoteric language, yesterday. So I'll read again an excerpt that says, in the name of truth, it must be said that it fell to me to work as an initiate or bodhisattva in past Mahamanvantaras. And in the reality of truth, I knew the ancient earth moon. When that satellite was a world like our world, it had rich mineral, vegetable, animal, and human life, stormy seas and erupting volcanoes, etc. All of the satellites of our solar system formed a part of the past solar system that in esotericism is denominated the lunar chain. In esotericism, the period of activity is denominated Mahamanvantara. The period of the cosmic night is denominated Pralaya. So then the moon had life, and it is the mother of the earth. It is necessary to understand this. When the cosmic night arrived, the lunar life was pushed over into the superior dimensions of nature, and the cosmos and the geological crust was left deserted. That is, the seas were becoming depleted, evaporating, and the volcanoes exhausted their fires after the seventh race. The moon had seven great races, but at the ending of the seventh great race, the whole lunar life was pushed over into the fourth dimension. Much later into the fifth, afterwards into the sixth, and finally into the seventh dimension. The physical crust, properly said, was left deserted, turned into a cadaver, and that whole past solar system, whose only exponents today are the lunar satellites of our actual system, died physically, but continues existing from the point of view of that which is called substance. That is to say, the final synthesis, it remained converted into something that we would call pro-matter, into something called Iliaster. Okay, so the moon that we see in the sky was previously a planet like the Earth in a previous cosmic day. Now, obviously, we share a great karma also with the moon, and that so many processes that affected that time, that Mahamanvantara, repeat themselves again here. And then it's in that Mahamanvantara, the Padma of Gold, that the being Samael achieves the first philosopher's stone. Now that brings us to this current cosmic day, this current Mahamanvantara. which is the planet Earth, with its seven rounds, of which we're now in the fourth round. And here, the being Samael is now converted or elevated to a degree of Cosmocrator. And he participates in the dawn of creation in this solar system. And he himself says in chapter 37 of My Return to Tibet, he says, Christic esotericism mentions the seven creator spirits in front of the throne of the Lamb. Therefore, it's important to clarify this matter and to place at once the cards over the table. These seven Cosmocrators are the same Dhyani Chohans, who clearly correspond to the Hebrew Elohim. The cosmic order is the following. The Moon, the Regent Gabriel, Mercury, the Regent Raphael, Venus, the Regent Uriel, Sun, the Regent Mikael, Mars, the Regent Samael, Jupiter, the Regent Zachariel, Saturn, the Regent Orifael. It is unquestionable that the Dhyanis successively watch over each one of the seven rounds and root races that of our planetary chain. It is ostensible that each one of the seven emanates from himself his own human soul, that is to say his bodhisattva, when it is necessary. Okay, so now this being Samael no longer is a normal bodhisattva, but now is a special one called a Dhyani bodhisattva, the son of a Cosmocrator. And each one of those Dhyanis come into each one of the seven rounds. In fact, become the avatar of those rounds. Gabriel with the protoplasmic race, Raphael with the Hyperboreans, Uriel with the Lemurians, Mikael with the Atlanteans, and finally Samael, the avatar of this Aryan race. And then he says, in regards to himself, he says, however, in respect to myself, I am the Bodhisattva of the Lord of the Innermost. I do not ever pretend to boast of being perfect. My duty is to teach the fifth truth, the fifth gospel, the fifth Veda. It's not necessary to wait for the coming of the fifth round, as many believe, in order for my doctrine to be known. Here you have my doctrine. Therefore, whosoever hears my voice and follows it, I will liken him unto a wise man who built his house upon the living rock, and the floods and the storms came and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was built upon a solid foundation. And as we know, that fifth truth that he comes to deliver is the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that fallen bodhisattvas can raise themselves and that humanoids can become real men. And so why is it that Master Samael always speaks with such an authority on the topics of the creation, the origin of man, and so many other things? And he says here, I am aware of the dawn of life. I was present at the dawn of creation. I am here with humanity since the dawn of creation, when the heart of the solar system began to throb after the profound night of the great pralaya. So the next thing I wanted to reflect about was Master Samael himself has said that the fifth of the seven archangels and their bodhisattvas, the fifth Samael, has suffered the most. And we can reflect that suffering itself is the great teacher of nature, that always through moments of suffering, when we transform those moments of suffering, on the other side of this is a great wisdom. And so when Samael has suffered the most, this also implies a certain wisdom that he attains through this. And what does this mean that he's suffered the most? Well, first of all, we know that the fifth of the seven archangels comes at a very mathematical moment when the earth has reached its densest form, when it conquers the physical round and now the Aryan race at its most distant place from the absolute. So obviously this is one connotation. Also, that being Samael has sent his bodhisattva into each one of the races, the seven main races of the planet, as well as each of its seven sub-races. And imagine all the experience that's attained through all of those existences. And that's what I want to speak about right now. So, as we know, each planet has seven important main races. And for this planet, the first race was called the protoplasmic or the polar race. Master Samael describes in detail always about the protoplasmatic people that lived in the fourth dimension, obviously because he also existed there. And the second was the Hyperborean. And then finally, the third races, which were the Lemurians. And here, as we know in the Gnostic teachings, is a big story. Because remember, up until this point, he is still raised. He has one philosopher's stone. But there's also a great mystery of the philosopher's stones. The mystery of the Philosopher's Stones is that there's seven stones, and that each stone is more powerful than the previous one because of the new experiences that have to be conquered. But in order to go from one stone to another stone, that stone has to be lost. And imagine that the Philosopher's Stone actually has an expiration date to it. So it's in Lemuria where Samael then loses the first Philosopher's Stone. And this is recorded in history and also in the writings of Master Samael as the Angelic Rebellion. And so that loss of the Philosopher's Stone indicates a fall, a loss of all the powers, the faculties, the connections of that stone, and even the creation now of the ego. But it's also in that same time of Lemuria that Master Samael is then able to raise himself again completely and achieve now a second Philosopher's Stone. And remember, each stone has more power, more consciousness contained within it, is more powerful than the previous one. Now he describes something extraordinary. He's able to live now with a second Philosopher's Stone, which also gives him an immortal Lemurian body. And he's able to live through the catastrophes of Lemuria over 10,000 or more years, he reports, then into the beginnings of the Atlantean race, through the entire Atlantean race, and also even accompanies the Manu Vaisvasvata, who's also known as the biblical Noah, who's leading now an exodus of chosen people from Atlantis, who will be saved from the floods of Atlantis, and they then establish themselves to begin the processes of the next race, or the fifth race, which is the Aryan race, in the central plateau of Asia. And I think it's very significant that Master Samael accompanies Manu Vaisvata in that regard, because also what he's doing is he's learning. Imagine that there's actually a big process, a big responsibility to run an exodus that's responsible for establishing a new golden age. And Samael, in this sense, learns this process, or learns, is like an apprentice in this moment. And he'll have to draw on that knowledge, obviously, in these moments that we're living now. But going back, imagine for a moment how long he had this second Philosopher's Stone, from the ends of Lemuria through the whole Atlantean race and the beginnings of the Aryan race. Now he says something happens. In the central plateau of Asia, which is now the fifth race, he then loses that second Philosopher's Stone. And he says, it was precisely in the Oriental world during that brilliant Aryo-Atlantean time when I committed an error similar to that one committed by Count Zanoni. Such a count became in love with a beautiful artist from Naples. Thus the outcome was frightful because he died in the guillotine during the French Revolution. Count Zanoni was an immortal Chaldean. He received the elixir of long life in ancient times, and it is clear to comprehend that sex was forbidden to him. My case was similar. I was an ancient Lemurian with an immortal body. I also fell into the arms of Kundry, that Eve from Hebraic mythology, the woman of Antomasia. Hence, the outcome was the fatal loss of my precious Lemurian vehicle. It's written with characters of fire in the Book of Life that any resurrected master must not return to sex. This is known by the divine and human. The violation of this great law signifies death. It is evident that my capital error was that I accepted the gift of Cupid at the height of my youth. Therefore, I tell to human beings and gods that they should always avoid immortalizing a young physical body. And then he begins another process now as, again, a fallen bodhisattva. And in the first sub-race of this Aryan race, which takes place in the central plateau of Asia, that same place, which is now Tibet, he enters into an important order that's called the Sacred Order of Tibet, and he becomes an authentic lama of that order. He says, though, he makes a critical mistake and was expelled. In this most current existence, he again was able to return to that sacred order, and as he returned, he met a great master who reminded him of his mistakes, and here's what he says. What a majestic countenance! He looked like a living Christ. Many cosmic days and cosmic nights were reflected within his eyes. His sacred beard was a living representation of the universal verb of life, and his immaculate hair falling upon his ineffable shoulders was reminding me of the Ancient of Days from the Hebraic Kabbalah. He spoke and said terrible things. He mentioned a woman who I had known after the submersion of the old Atlantean continent. Do you remember such a lady? Yes, I do, Venerable Master, I do remember her. It is evident that in those ancient times I had failed because of her. Do you remember this other lady? Yes, I do, Venerable Master, I do remember her. Then the living remembrance of a Tibetan queen came to my mind. So long ago, about 1 million years in the past, in the center of Asia, in the very heart of the Himalayas, on the site of Tibet, a marvelous kingdom existed. The inhabitants of that country were the outcome of the Aryan-Atlantean mixture. Every esotericist knows very well that the first sub-race from our present fifth root race flourished in the center of Asia. I lived in that old country and I knew its sighted queen, that lady who the master was reminding me of in a recriminating way. She came to me when I was a priest from the Sacred Order of Tibet. The unhappy one was suffering. Thus she told me her tragedies. The monarch, her husband, was in love with another woman, and it is obvious that the disgraced queen had fallen into desperation. I wanted to help her. I did what I could for her. However, I committed many errors. To assault private minds is a crime. Thus, to deny my own errors would be an absurdity. I used my psychic powers in an evidently negative way, and I even committed the error of receiving some money in payment for it. So the royal treasury paid me a sum of money on account of the expenses of the queen. Her husband abandoned his concubine. Thus the king and queen were reconciled for the good of that country. Apparently I did a good deed. However, let us remember the words of the Master Moria. Crime is also hidden within the rhyme of poetry. It becomes clearly comprehensible, by all means, that I fell into absurdity, that I committed stupidities. Thus, for such a motive, in spite of being a twice-born, I was severely punished. So then again, expelled and fallen, he now has another existence that he talks about in China, which is now the second sub-race. So again, I want to emphasize, see the way that the Bodhisattva is having experiences in every one of the sub-races of this Aryan race, because this is significant for when he finally brings his teachings at the end of this race, where he has teachings like a synthesis that apply to every one of the sub-races of this planet. That's why Master Samael brings teachings from China, from Buddhist traditions, from Taoist traditions, from Egyptian traditions, from the Mayans, from the Aztecs, from the Christian tradition, from every place of the planet, as we'll see. And so he talks about having many existences in China, but one that stood out for him was that he entered into the Sacred Order of the Yellow Dragon. And this order, these were experts of meditation. And he learns the science of meditation really well here. This is where he describes that they had a sacred instrument called the Ayatapan, which had 49 notes, which was equivalent to the 7 notes of the musical scale in 7 octaves. And he said that what they would do, the brothers of this temple, where they would sit to meditate, and then someone would play this instrument, and the first note according to Do, the second to Re, the third to Mi, and they would conquer the corresponding zones of the subconscious until they finally could free their essence completely and enter into the illuminating void to experience ecstasy. And he said in those moments, the personality was completely passive. The emotional, motor, and intellectual centers were completely integrated and completely unified. And so that then, through the silver cord, the physical brain, the body, the three brains themselves could receive the knowledge of what they were experiencing in the illuminating void. And I think that also this was something really important for Master Samael to experience, because as we know, in this most recent existence as Victor Manuel Gomez, he's an absolute master of meditation, an absolute master of samadhi. And he's able to transmit this marvelously in his teachings of meditation. Then he has a next existence in the third subrace, which is takes place in ancient Egypt. And here, again, he says that he returns back to the mysteries. He learns once again the practice of the alchemy, the Arcanum Azf, and he even becomes the teacher of the pharaoh Khafre. But here, after entering into that school of mysteries, he's able to once again reconquer the state of man, the state of bodhisattva. And he completes the first mountain. Now, amazingly, his being then disincarnates him. and is able to mummify that physical vehicle, according to the science of the Egyptians of that time, of living mummies. And that vehicle will be used 4,000 plus years into the future. Master Samael comments one time about the incredible foresight that the being has to be able to see 4,000 years into the future and the necessity they would have of that physical vehicle. And this is now that same vehicle that the master currently uses with his third philosopher's stone. Okay, so after that notable existence in Egypt, his next existence now is in the fourth subrace of Rome, and this time as Gaius Julius Caesar, or Julius Caesar. And here he was given a mission directly from the White Lodge to establish a strong foundation of the fourth subrace. And if you're a student of history, you'll realize how influential Julius Caesar was really for the whole of the Western world, to the whole history of the world, the whole structure of Europe, of America. So many things are based on those Roman principles established by Julius Caesar in that existence. Now, here also is a teaching that, remember, in the previous existence, Samael was raised. He had finished the first mountain. So that means when he enters into the body of Julius Caesar, he's now comes with those same esoteric degrees. And imagine for a moment the charisma, the power, the force that Julius Caesar had. It surely has that flavor. But he says here again, he makes some critical mistakes. And one of those mistakes was being a bit impatient. And he entered into an order that was called the Order of Jarterra, which was a club of generals and senators, very influential people in those Roman times. And it was a place where you could advance politically. But of course, this resulted in a fall for him. And as a result, he loses those esoteric degrees that he had just previously attained in the existence in Egypt. And you see this process of trying to raise once again, which is sometimes a process of up and down. And he says that if he had been more patient, the White Lodge would have been able to move things for him to achieve the ranking of Julius Caesar that he needed. But he wanted it to be quicker, and he made really an incredible mistake. And anyway, we all know the history then of Julius Caesar, how he's betrayed and assassinated. He talks about Brutus, who was his friend, who had developed an eye of envy really strongly. And Brutus comes again and again in different existences, ultimately impulsed by this eye of envy. Even in this current existence, Brutus comes with Victor Manuel Gomez. But this time, it's definitive because Master Samael reports that Brutus eventually goes into the involution. But that's a whole nother story. It's curious that Master Samael didn't have a physical body during the times of Jesus, because his next existence then is with a young man who travels with Paul of Tarsus. And remember that Jesus came physically between the times of Julius Caesar and then this time of Paul of Tarsus. And he's traveling through Rome, and he says now he's a fallen bodhisattva. And a fallen bodhisattva, Master Samael teaches us, retains so many forces and has such a strong sense of inner justice, but doesn't have the balance, doesn't have the control, and obviously has the ego fully intact to be able to manage that sense of justice. And usually this gets a fallen bodhisattva into trouble. And this was the case here. When he was traveling with Paul of Tarsus, Paul was speaking about the doctrine of the Christ within the Roman Empire. And with a lot of enthusiasm of the moment, the young man who was this now fallen bodhisattva of Samael begins to publicly criticize the Roman Empire. And of course, in those times of the Roman Empire, this was something really dangerous and something that was considered a crime. And unfortunately, there was a guard that was standing close by and overheard him criticizing very publicly the Roman Empire. And that guard then took him to see the praetor, who's like the judge or the administrator of justice of those times. And the praetor even asks him, "Did you say these things?" And that fallen bodhisattva, again, strongly criticizes the empire right in front of the praetor. And the praetor sentences him to death. And Master Samael talks about then being for some time in a prison, and his friends came by to say goodbye to him through a little opening in the wall. And then he was taken finally for his execution. And he says an enormous African man came that wore a turban and had a ring in his nose and carried with him a huge mace. And he swung the mace at this young man, and he blocked the first blow with his arm. He broke one arm. He blocked another one with the other arm and broke that arm. And then finally, the third hit was definitive and hit him in the head. And that ended that very short existence as the young fallen bodhisattva with Paul of Tarsus. Master Samael, though, says, in this current existence as Victor Manuel Gomez, the karmic law paid him that debt of having those broken bones. And in this current existence, he says he had really strong bones and perfect teeth. And I think that's true, because when you see sometimes a photograph of Master Samael, you see that beautiful smile he has with absolutely perfect teeth. And so that was a payment from the law. Now he talks about many other existences he had in the Roman Empire. One significant one was during the times of the Emperor Nero. He says that the historians, he says, for example, what have they written? Just fantasies. What do they say about Nero? That he was a homosexual, that he even got married with another man. What's the origin of that information? Are they sure about that? He says, in the name of truth, I must say that I was reincarnated in the era of Nero, and he was nothing of a homosexual. I saw him many times passing through the gates of ancient Rome, sitting on his berth on the shoulders of his slaves. He was a man of ample forehead and robust Herculean body. Historians do not say so. They emphasize the idea of an abominable poet. Instead of being surrounded by homosexuals, I always saw him with his women. I lived in Nero's era, and I can give a testimony of that. Historians have falsified the truth about that man. Then he reports another existence in Rome where he knew, obviously, some of the esoteric mysteries. Even as a fallen bodhisattva, still has powers and faculties. And at one moment, he helped one of the other Caesars of Rome, and he used the magic of the elemental of the magwai plant. And he gives a special practice working with this. And he used it to reconcile differences between two enemies. And he says it was a great success. Then we have existences now in Europe, which is the fifth subrace of this Aryan race. And again, he continues to have existences, still as a fallen bodhisattva, obviously with a lot of difficulties, a lot of problems, a lot of suffering. He talks about one existence he had in the Middle Ages, where he actually encountered the venerable master Cagliostro. And he says, I personally met Cagliostro in Austria. In those times, he passed as the Count Phoenix. I was in rough shape. I was a fallen bodhisattva. I encountered him in a restaurant in old Vienna to give me advice from mouth to ear. Much later, I visited him at his home. He had an old mirror of rock crystal. He was able to purify coal and made diamonds, and he also transmuted physical lead into gold. These are maybe some of the powers that the being has with the Philosopher's Stone that a great master like Cagliostro was able to demonstrate physically. And in that existence, Count Cagliostro tried to bring Master Samael back to the path again, but it didn't seem like it worked. He also reports many existences as a knight. Imagine the son of the god of war. It must have been a formidable swordsman. And he talks about an existence where he says, it is necessary to emphasize that the author of my days, that's his physical father in this current existence, was in the medieval times during the age of chivalry. He was a nobleman whom I had defeated in a bloody battle. He had sworn then to take revenge, and it is clear that he fulfilled this in this present existence. In this present existence, as Victor Manuel Gomez, his father really gave him a difficult time, and his father was that same feudal knight from the past who had swore revenge. He also had a very notable experience as Thomas A. Kempis, from Europe. Thomas Kempis, he says, let's remember that phrase which in an old existence I put into one of my books. I am no more because they praise me, or less because they vituperate me, because I am what I am. Then they gave me the name of Thomas A. Kempis, and I wrote The Imitation of Christ. I belonged to an esoteric order. I was a monk, even though there in the monastery that was not known. So imagine, even in that fallen condition, he continues to accumulate incredible values and do incredible works like the work of Thomas Kempis. And he even belonged again to an esoteric order, as he said, even though that was hidden under the the guys of the church of that time. That prayer that he makes, that he wrote in the Imitation of Christ, is really a valuable teaching as well, and something that can be applied in our lives. And you see that how even back then, even deep within him, he was still teaching the death of the ego in that way, or working on himself in that way. And so the next existence he talks about of significance took place in Austria. And here he's part of a very wealthy aristocratic family. And in this existence, he makes a mistake that he says was made from good intentions. But here he gives the teaching that even good intentions lead us to the abyss. He said that in that time, his sister married a very poor man and they had a child. And the poor man died, and the sister had been highly criticized for marrying this man and was ostracized by the family. And he says that him, out of good intention, he took the child away from his sister to give the child an upright education and all the false values of the world. And he said this caused his sister a lot of pain because he was so cruel, even with his idea of good intentions, that he didn't permit the son or the mother even to see each other. And this is what he says about that. He said, "My sister was suffering greatly because of the absence of her son, and she could not even see him at the college, as was prohibited for her. By all means, it is clear that from my part there was love for my nephew and cruelty for my sister. However, I thought that if I were helping the son, I was also helping his mother. Fortunately, as if by magic, the police of karma, the kaom, emerge inside of each one of us, within those intimate regions where love is missing. To flee from the agents of karma is not possible, since inside each one of us exists the police who inevitably will conduce us towards the tribunals. Many centuries have passed since that epoch. All of the personages from that drama became old and died. However, the law of recurrence is terrible, because everything is repeated as it once happened, along with its consequences. He says, in the 20th century, we, all the actors of that past event, have re-encountered one another again. Everything has been repeated in a certain way, but it's clear that it has been with consequences. This time, I was the one who was repudiated by the family. In this current existence, Victor Manuel Gomez was born into a relatively wealthy family and then had to leave those circumstances and was also criticized in the same way. And so he says, such is the law. My sister re-encountered her husband anew. I do not reject the fact that I am united again with my ancient priestess spouse, known with the name of Litalantes. The so adored and fought over nephew became reborn again, this time with a feminine body. She, by the way, is a very beautiful girl. Her face seems to be a very delightful night, and the stars shine in her eyes. One time, the day does not matter now, we were living next to the sea. The girl, my ancient nephew, could not play as she was grievously ill with an intestinal infection. It was a very delicate situation, as various children of her age died in that time because of the same cause. Why should my daughter be an exception? The numerous remedies which were administered to her, frankly, were useless. In her infantile face, the unmistakable profile of death was already starting to be drawn with horror. By all means, the failure was standing out. The case was lost. And I did not have any other chance than to visit the dragon of the law, the terrible genie of karma, whose name is Anubis. Fortunately, thanks be given to God, we, Litalantes and I, know how to consciously and positively travel in the astral body. Therefore, it was not a problem for us to present ourselves together in this palace of the great Archon, within the parallel universe of the fifth dimension. That temple of karma is impressive, majestic, and grandiose. The hierarch was there, seated on his throne, imposing and terribly divine. Anyone would be frightened to see him, officiating with that sacred mask of a jackal, just as he appears in the many embossments of the ancient Egypt of the pharaohs. Finally, the opportunity to talk to him was granted to me, and I clearly did not let it pass away so easily. "You have a debt with me," I told him. "Which one?" he answered, astonished. Then, completely satisfied, I introduced to him a man who in aforetime was a perverse demon. I am referring to Astaroth, the great duke. "This was a lost son for the father," I continued saying unto him. "Nonetheless, I saved him by showing him the path of the light. I took him out of the Black Lodge, and now he is a disciple of the White Brotherhood, and you did not pay me this debt. It was the case that this daughter of mine had to die in accordance with the law, in her soul was to penetrate within the womb of my sister in order to form a new physical body for my daughter. This is how I understood it. Therefore, I added, I ask that Azeroth can go into the womb of my sister instead of the soul of my daughter. The solemn answer of this hierarch was definitive. Granted, let Azeroth go into the womb of your sister, and let your daughter be healed. Therefore, that girl, who was my ancient nephew, was miraculously healed, and then my sister had a male child. I had capital in order to pay the debt. I had cosmic capital. The law of karma is not a blind mechanical law, as many pseudo-esotericists and pseudo-occultists suppose. As these matters show, it became evident and easy to comprehend that with the possible death of my daughter, I had to feel the same pain of detachment, the same bitterness which is in an ancient epoch my sister felt for the loss of her son. Thus, by means of the great law, the damage would be compensated with the repetition of similar scenes. However, this time I myself would be the victim. Fortunately, karma is negotiable. This law is not the blind mechanicity of the astrologers and the chiromancers of Varus. So in that is a great teaching that Master Samael gives about the capacity to negotiate our karma and how important it is that we also have the values to present in that type of negotiation. Another existence he talks about having in Europe, which is also interesting, where he says that that town he lived in Europe was invaded by pirates, and the pirates pillaged the town and they took many of the young women of the town. One of them was his daughter of those times. And so he says he went onto the ship of the pirate, and in spite of the terror of the inhabitants, I bravely managed putting my own life in danger to confront that treacherous captain of the pirate ship. And then he said to the pirate, he said, take my daughter away from that hell where you have put her, and I promise that I will take your soul from that hell which it is in now. He says, such were my painful exclamations. And he said, that fearful pirate, looking at me fiercely, took pity on my insignificant person, and with an imperative voice ordered me to wait a moment. And then the pirate then returned his daughter to him. And he uses this again as a teaching, because he says, oh God, and Hail Mary, but who could have thought that after several centuries I would find again the ego of this fearful pirate reincorporated in a new human organism? Thus the law of eternal return of all beings and things, and everything is repeated according to another law, that of recurrence. He said he actually discovered this guy in the most current existence, this time becoming an aspirant to enter into the school of the Rosicrucians. And he said that that old pirate spoke now in English and talked about his many travels, and that he is now a seaman working for a North American shipping company. But Master Samael says that that friendship kind of ended after a little while, because he realized that the guy was still a pirate, but now he was doing under the guise of a modern way with business and different dealings as a seafarer. So he broke ties with the person at that time. But astonishingly, 35 years later, he says, one spring night, being absent from my dense mortal form, I saw the Lord Shiva, the Holy Ghost, my sacred super-individual monad, with the ineffable appearance of the Ancient of Days. The Lord was admonishing the old pirate of the sea with great severity. It is unquestionable that his physical body was asleep in his bed at that time of the night. Eagerly, I wanted to intervene as a third party in the discord. The Ancient of Centuries ordered me in a strong manner to be quiet. Years ago, the pirate had given me back my daughter, had taken her away from the hell in which he himself had put her. Now my real being, Samael, struggled to free and emancipate him, to take him away from the infernal worlds. How amazing is that, that he makes this promise so many centuries ago, and the Logos keeps that promise and is still trying to help him even now. Then the next existence now, he speaks about at length in The Mystery of the Golden Blossom, which is as the Marquis Juan Conrado, who is the third Grand Lord of the province of Granada, Spain. This was the times of the Spanish Empire, when the Spanish were conquering the Americas and traveling back and forth, bringing a lot of wealth back as well. And he says that he did this as that governor. And he said that he traveled to those American lands He said, "I must assert that I never intended to plunder sacred temples of august mysteries, to conquer villages or destroy citadels. I certainly traveled those American lands in search of fortune. Unfortunately, I made some mistakes. To study them is necessary in order to know the parallels and to consciously verify the wise law of recurrence. Those were my times as a fallen bodhisattva. Incidentally, there was no tame sheep. The centuries has passed, the sense of conscious consciousness. Never been able to forget such foolishness. The first parallel that I must study corresponds exactly to my present physical body. Having arrived from the mother country in that fragile craft, I settled down very near to the cliffs of the Atlantic coast. In the times of the Spanish conquest, there was that other unfortunate international trade that had to do with the infamous sale of African Negroes. And so, for better or for worse, I met a noble colored family from Algeria. Still, I remember a maiden as black and as beautiful as a miraculous dream from the Arabian Nights. If I shared the bed of pleasures in the Garden of Delight with her, it was actually because I was moved by the incentive of curiosity. I wanted to see the outcome of this racial mixing. It was not at all strange that out of this mulatto offspring was born, and later on, a great-grandchild and a great-grandchild and a great-great-grandchild were born. In those fallen bodhisattva times, I forgot the famous astral marks which originate in coitus and which all the disincarnated carry in their karmasaya. It is clearly evident that such marks connect one with those people in blood associated with chemical intercourse. This is an opportune moment to mention that the Hindustani yogis have already made detailed studies about this. To assert that my present-day physical body has evolved from the aforementioned metaphysical intercourse would not be irrelevant. In other words, I will say that it is how I came to be clothed in the flesh which I carry in my present existence. My forefathers were the descendants of exactly that sexual act of the Marquis. It's astonishing that our descendants, through time and space, become our ancestors. It is marvelous that after centuries, we will be sheathed in our own flesh to become the children of our own children. Endless journeys through the lands of New Spain characterize the life of the Marquis, and those are repeated in my subsequent existences, including this present one. So he recognizes that he becomes his own ancestor. And that's the same for us, how we can sometimes move in same family lines. Also during that existence, he returned again once back to Spain. And this time he began to have difficulties with his former enemy, who was Brutus when he was Julius Caesar. And he says this, he says he was again re-embodied within a new human organism. What an incisive count, offensive and ironic. He mocked me. What insults, what sarcasm. I wanted no involvement whatsoever in new controversies and had no appetite for anger. The coarseness, vulgarity, and lack of culture of that nobleman displeased me frightfully, but I did not want to criticize him. It seemed a good idea to avoid new duels, and for that reason I sought the Inquisitor. One day, early in the morning, I made my way to the palace of the Inquisition. I had to find an intelligent solution to my time-worn problem. So then he ends up gaining an audience with the Inquisitor, and he gives his complaints at that time, and the Inquisitor says, "Oh yes, we've had a lot of different complaints about this same guy. I'm going to give orders to arrest him immediately. We will imprison him in the Martyr's Tower. We'll pull out his fingernails and toenails and pour molten lead on his fingers to torture him. Then we will sear the soles of his feet with burning coals and finally burn him alive on a bonfire." And then Master Samael says, "But for God's sake, had the monk gone mad? I never planned to go that far. All I sought in that Inquisition house was a Christian admonition for the Count who had reincorporated those values which were formerly ingrained in Brutus's personality. The blue monk seated before the sacred table with his penitent countenance, the attitude of a pious anchorite, a crucifix hanging from his neck. That singularly beatific figure, so devout and so cruel, so sweet and barbaric, so sanctimonious and perverse. Such evil, a wolf in sheep's clothing, awoke something in the interior of my consciousness. I don't know what. I felt that what I possessed of bodhisattva was rebelling, protesting, groaning. An inner storm erupted in me. Lightning, thunder did not delay in appearing. And then, oh God, what had to happen happened. You are perverse, I told him. I didn't come here to ask you to burn anyone alive. I came only to request that this nobleman be admonished. You're a murderer. That's why I do not belong to your sect, etc. Ah, so is that it, my dear Marquis? Infuriated, the prelate vehemently rang a loud handbell. And then, if by magic, some knights appeared armed to the teeth. Arrest him, exclaimed the abbot. One moment, Master Samael said. The rules of chivalry must be respected. Remember that you are among knights. I give no sword. Give me one, and I will fight each one of you. One of the men, faithful to the code of chivalry, handed me a sword, and then I attacked him like a lion. My reputation as a swordsman was not in vain. Those were my times as a fallen bodhisattva. Just as frozen snowflakes fall through the air at the gust of the ethereal north winds, strong, resplendent helmets, convex shields, heavy breastplates, and ashwood lances scattered within the inquisitorial enclosure. Its splendor rose up to Uranus, and certainly the earth laughed, illuminated by the brilliance of bronze trembling under the feet of the fighters, amongst them myself, struggling in a tough battle against the other knight. In that moment, Master Samael, as a good swordsman, began to win the battle, and he was almost ready to take out the knight when finally he said, because of fear, all of the other knights in the room rushed at him and forgot the rules of chivalry. And he said he fought and he fought and he fought until he couldn't even lift his sword anymore. He was so exhausted. And then they finally took him and they arrested him there. And he says, after that, it was terrible. He said, what took place afterwards is easy to guess. I was burned alive on a bonfire in that very courtyard of the Palace of the Inquisition. I was mercilessly lashed to a stake over green wood, which blazed with a slow fire. I felt pain that is impossible to describe in words. Then I saw how my poor incinerated flesh fell off in the flames. But human pain, no matter how severe, also has a well-defined limit beyond which there is happiness. It's not so strange that at the end I experienced a certain happiness. I felt about me something very pleasant, as if a refreshing and beneficent shower had fallen from the sky. It occurred to me to take a step. How light I felt. I left the palace walking very slowly, very slowly. I weighed nothing. I was disembodied. In another commentary, Master Samael said, in this current existence, he said, if I was faced with that same situation, there would be a different outcome. He says, because now I've dissolved the ego of anger, I've dissolved the ego of impatience, and I would have known how to remain serene, and I would have been able to go and warn that enemy that the Inquisitor was after him, and it would have been a different outcome anyway. But it's amazing to see that also that teaching about how after sometimes intense pains that we go through, that always then there's a type of happiness, a type of relief that comes, no matter what we're facing. Next, after that existence, Master Samael says, for the benefit of many readers, it would not be irrelevant to emphasize to a certain extent the unrefined assertion that after a short interval in the region of the dead, I entered the new scene anew, reincarnating in England. I entered into the bosom of the illustrious Bleller family, and I was christened with the pious name of Simon. And here, as this in this existence as Simon Bleller, he again moves to Spain from England by recurrence, and then again returns to the Americas. And there he lives a really difficult life. He pays a tremendous amount of karma in that existence. He says really the best thing that he did in that existence was towards the end, he helped the Aboriginal people, the indigenous peoples that were there. He used to work with natural medicines and healing and would heal people and never asked for any compensation for that. And then those indigenous Aboriginal people that he began to study a little bit of esotericism with as well, later in this last existence, he says, become his first disciples in forming the Gnostic movement. And then finally, his previous incarnation to being Victor Manuel Gomez now takes place in the sixth subrace, which is now in Latin America. And this incarnation, he's known as Daniel Coronado. Here he once again finds Litalantis. He's married to her. Her name in that existence was Ligia Paca. And he says that the best things he did really in that existence was to fight in the Mexican Revolution with Pancho Villa. And then he also forms an esoteric group right in Mexico City. And towards the end of his life, he dies homeless and in a very difficult circumstances, which I find is amazing to consider that the next existence will be born as Victor Manuel Gomez Rodriguez on the 6th of March, 1917 in Colombia. And from there, be able to raise himself completely and fulfill the mission that he has as the avatar of this age and as a Dhyani Bodhisattva. It's really amazing to consider how many existences he passes through, some that are very illustrious and some that are practically insignificant, some paying great amounts of karma and others more elevated. So then we know this story well of his incarnation in Victor Manuel Gomez Rodriguez, where he now takes up the secret path, studying from a very early age, seeking esotericism, passing through the schools of theosophy, of Rosicrucianism, where he learns once again the alchemy, in the same way that he had learned it again in the Egyptian existence, and now is able to take up the great work. And he awakens the fire at the age of 30, takes 30 more years to complete the first and second mountains, and completes the great work in 1977. On the 24th of December 1977, he disincarnates physically and then goes through the process of the resurrection of the intimate Christ 3 days later in the 27th of December. Of course, now working invisibly, but still directing and guiding the Gnostic movement. Now, I think that we as Gnostic people have a big responsibility. And that big responsibility is to connect with him. The way to connect to Samael now is through internal experiences, through revelation. And those always come when we're working on ourselves, when we're following the three factors, and sometimes when we least expect it and need it the most. So now we can consider that Samael has achieved three philosopher's stones. And he himself says, this is not the end, because this is the great mystery of the philosopher's stones, as we said in the beginning, that the philosopher's stones are actually seven. And the goal is to return back to the Absolute with full consciousness, to become a conscious inhabitant of the Absolute, or what's called a Paramattasaya. And so that path of the Philosopher's Stones is huge, because each stone then eventually needs to be renewed. The first three stones are done through falls, and those falls provoke a tremendous amount of suffering, because always the higher that we are is the greater the depth of the fall. The last stones number 4, 5, 6, and 7, are done through descents. And this is the path of the Cosmocrators. And so Master Samael then, or the being, the Logos Samael, the region of Mars, obviously is fulfilling that role for this Mahamanvantara. But he says when this role finishes, he'll move on. And the being will take him to another universe, another place, to complete that path of the Philosopher's Stones. And then obviously there will be another being that's being prepared now to take up that role in a future Mahamanvantara. So I say all of these things for us always to realize that this is every one of us, that each one of us has a being, a monad. Each one of us has a tremendous history. This essence, this soul that we have is very old. And how marvelous it is that we work on ourselves, that we awaken our consciousness, and that we begin to know the mystery of our own being, the mystery of our own existences, which is absolutely tremendous. And then to even consider the future, the path that our own being is following. This is something imperative, I think, for each Gnostic aspirant, each Gnostic student, each Gnostic missionary to realize. To realize that Samael is guiding us, that he's helping us, that we also are a part of something that is absolutely huge. So I'd like to leave with one thing from Master Samael, where he says, every person must decide once in their life whether to launch themselves to triumph, risking everything, or to sit to contemplate the triumphant ones passing by. I hope that this has been enjoyable and helpful. I welcome any questions or comments that can be made through email And once again, I would like to thank the guys at Karate Radio, Elio and Annabelle, for their efforts, and again for inviting me to speak about this important topic. And thank you very much for everyone who listens.
Thank you very much, Daniel, for sharing this wonderful talk and for reminding us of the work, the path, and the process of Master Samael and how it relates to each and every one of us. And this talk, I think, has inspired many, will inspire many to come who will be listening to it. So we thank you for that. And to our listeners, we will be taking questions via email, and they will be responded via email. It will not be responded on today's live activity. So if you have any questions, you may send them, and we will be sure to forward them, and they will be answered, each and every one of them. So thank you very much. Till next time, take care, and reverential peace.